Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we'll meet a biologist who is considered one of the foremost researchers on the behaviors and ecological significance of the American prairie dog. Dr. John Hoagland is a professor of biology at the University of Maryland and has studied several of the prairie dog's five subspecies for over 40 years. And he's the author of several important texts on prairie dog behavior. Once numbering in the billions, prairie dog populations across the western United States have plummeted over the past 100 years, due largely to eradication efforts from farmers and ranchers and through loss of habitat from urban development. While the prairie dog is being considered for listing as an endangered species, agricultural and ranching interests have fiercely resisted that designation, and as of today, there are no protections for the species. Nonetheless, biologists consider the prairie dog to be the keystone species of the western grasslands, providing numerous species with prey food. But more interesting to researchers like Hoagland is their complex social rituals, language skills, and familial relationships. He'll be speaking about that this afternoon in a University of Tulsa Biological Science seminar, this afternoon at 3 o'clock in TU's Oliphant Hall, room 300. The lecture is free and open to the public. He'll be talking about the behavioral ecology of prairie dogs, insights from long-term research. He joins me today as my guest on Studio Tulsa. John Hoagland, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Rich.
You've been studying prairie dogs for over 40 years. What first piqued your interest in the species?
Well, Rich, I first got interested in prairie dogs because I had a very simple question that I was exploring as a graduate student back in 1974. And that question was this: why do animals live in colonies? And I wanted to look at that question for a mammal that lives in colonies. Well, if I were asking that question now, I would just go to the internet and punch in mammal colony, United States can be captured and marked. Back then, I had to go to the library, but wherever you went, it was one very quickly could determine that the prairie dog was a good species to study if you want to study a small mammal that lives in colonies in the United States that you can capture and mark.
Now, I'm thinking about colonies. I can't think of really too many mammal species that do. I think of a lot of insect species, ants, for example. You know, there are plenty of insect species. Are there many mammal species that live in colonies?
Well, there are many mammals that live in colonies.
I guess ape species, you would consider that a colony.
Right, you're right. Chimpanzees and gorillas and most of the other apes as well. And, you know, you've got caribou, you've got bison, which live with prairie dogs.
Yeah.
So there are indeed many mammals that live in colonies. But for me, it was crucial that I'd be able to capture them and mark them and follow them as individuals. And prairie dogs were perfect for someone who had those interests.
And you've really described prairie dogs as the keystone species of the high plains and the mountain west. How important are they to the ecosystems?
Let's put it this way, Rich. There are five species of prairie dogs, but the most common one when people talk about prairie dogs is the black-tailed prairie dog. And it has been on and off the list of endangered species or the candidate list for endangered species. And if these prairie dogs disappear, the grasslands as we know them will be very different. And I'll just give you a couple of reasons why that is true. Prairie dogs serve as prey for many, many animals. Red foxes, coyotes, bobcats, badgers, golden eagles, prairie falcons. The list goes on and on. So if they disappear, suddenly you have all these animals that have to change their diets. Also, because prairie dogs live in these colonies and they consume many kinds of plants and they cut down other kinds of plants, and so because of that, the vegetation within prairie dog colonies is very different from vegetation you find anywhere else. And for that reason, you get certain animals that come to feed at prairie dog colonies. And if those colonies disappear, then these animals have to do something else. And also, you get certain plants that only grow at prairie dog colonies because of the way they bring up subsoil and they cut away other plants, so they remove the competition. So there's something called prairie dog weed that is found almost exclusively on prairie dog colonies, and there are other species as well. So you take away the prairie dogs, suddenly these plants have no place to live.
Are those beneficial plant species?
Well,
yes and no.
Yes and no. There you go. And here's perhaps the most important thing, Rich. Prairie dogs live in these underground, or they excavate these tunnels, which can be as deep as 5 meters or 15 feet and as long as 30 meters or 100 yards. So those burrows affect the water flow, the nutrient flow, but more importantly, they provide homes to many animals such as black-footed ferrets and hundreds of insects and spiders and things like tiger salamanders. So you take away the prairie dogs and suddenly you have a very different grassland ecosystem in western North America.
I've always read about the symbiotic relationship between bison and prairie dogs in the heyday of the great bison herds and the great prairie dog villages. I mean, because both were almost too many to count at one point in our history.
Right. When Lewis and Clark were going across the United States in their initial expedition, I think it was in 1803, they referred to prairie dogs as animals that occurred in infinite numbers. Nobody would use that reference right now. We still have prairie dogs, but they're just in these scattered small colonies. It's nothing like what it was in 1803.
And when you look at the history of man and prairie dog, since Europeans have come across, prairie dogs have been considered basically varmints and shot on sight, poisoned.
Correct.
And I think for a lot of misguided reasons. Isn't that the case?
Absolutely. There are two main reasons that prairie dogs have been shot and poisoned and obliterated over the last 150 years. One is ranchers are concerned that prairie dogs are competing with their cows and their horses and their sheep for food. And, Rich, there is some competition. I'm not going to say there's no competition. But there's good evidence that prairie dogs are eating certain plants and these horses and cows are eating other plants. So while there's some competition, there's a lot of non-overlap. But more importantly, in many circumstances, under many conditions, prairie dogs do things to the soil so that plants grow there that are more nutritious than plants off the prairie dog colonies. And that's why we find that bison or American buffalo are more likely to come into prairie dog colonies and feed, because there might be less grass, but what is there is better grass. It's got more nutrition. And so this myth is, I'm not going to say it's completely untrue, but it's largely untrue. And the other concern that ranchers have had is that cows and horses will step into a prairie dog burrow and break a leg. Well, prairie dog burrows at their entrances have these large mounds. They can be as high as a meter. And I'd be the first to agree that cows in particular are really stupid. But even cows will see this huge mound and walk around it. So over the last 40 years, I have talked to hundreds of ranchers. They're all worried about a broken leg of a horse or cow because of a prairie dog burrow, but I have not found a single one to whom it's actually happened.
So it's just one of these rural myths, I guess. We can't call it an urban myth, but it's a rural myth.
I would never say it never happened, but it is exceedingly rare. So what does that mean? That means for the last 150 years, we've been eliminating or destroying prairie dogs for all the wrong reasons.
Now, another part of that equation is the fact that with irrigation techniques, all of a sudden land that was not arable and not usable for agricultural uses have been able to be used. That's also created a competition issue.
Correct.
Has that had a major impact on the range of the prairie dog?
Yes. Shooting, poisoning, and destruction of habitat are the big three. Destruction of habitat because, hey, we need this area for a new Walmart. Or we need this area that 50 years ago we thought was worthless so prairie dogs can live there, but now we have ways of irrigating it, making it worthwhile, so now we can either graze our cows there or plant there. So, yeah, that's another key factor that has led to precipitous declines in prairie dog numbers.
And in recent years, there have been accounts of plague in prairie dog communities, and I guess there's been a lot of fears that that could move to human populations when humans are in close proximity. Has that been a big issue with
Yes, it's
dog?
A big issue, and here's why. Bubonic plague was introduced into the United States in about 1900, and it was first reported in prairie dogs in about 1940, so 60 or 70 years ago. Because it's an introduced disease, prairie dogs have no good defense, and when plague moves in most cases, the prairie dogs all die, or if they don't all die, 95 to 98 or 99% of them do. So it's just devastating for these prairie dog populations when plague moves in. Now, bubonic plague also affects people. And so it's the disease that's killing prairie dogs is the same disease that killed millions of humans back in the 1300s and potentially could kill humans again. So, yeah, that's another reason that people think, gosh, we got to get rid of all these prairie dogs. But even if plague is in a prairie dog colony and most of the prairie dogs die, if people just don't walk through the prairie dog colonies and stick their hands in burrows or whatever, don't handle the animals and don't put yourself in a position where you might pick up some fleas, the chances of getting plague are very, very slim for people.
Now, we've talked about the ecological needs of the prairie dog and why that it's important to our natural ecosystems, but probably the more fascinating part is how these prairie dogs live and how they communicate with one another. There's been lots of interesting research on how they communicate. They have a very sophisticated language. Can you explain how sophisticated that language is?
Well, for all of my 40 years of working with prairie dogs, I have been mesmerized by their communication system, and in particular, their alarm calling system. And when a predator enters a prairie dog colony, scores or sometimes hundreds of prairie dogs will be giving alarm calls. And it's different for each species. And you get the impression that all of the prairie dogs are calling. But if you do careful experiments with marked animals the way I have, you find that, yes, some of them do call, but some of them don't call. And so trying to determine who calls and who doesn't call has been, as I said, a major part of my research. And what we found is that for two of the species that I've studied, it's a simple case of mothers calling for babies. If I'm a mother and I've recently weaned a litter, I will give an alarm call. That's interesting of itself. But for the other two species, it's even more fascinating. Those prairie dogs, both males and females, will call not only for offspring, but also for more distant kin, such as nieces, nephews, grand offspring. And so it's not just taking care of your babies for these two species, but it's taking care of any relative. And this sort of gets to a point that I frequently make when I lecture about prairie dogs, and that is studying prairie dogs is like studying little people. If there's something we do, they do it as well and usually more often.
Really? And I would assume there are differences in the calls for, say, a mother calling her offspring as opposed to a father calling the extended family.
Correct.
How complex is their language? Can you give us a sense of the complexity
of
the
language? I have not done research on the complexity of the call, although people at other universities have, and there's indication that they give a specific call for badgers, a specific call for coyotes, a specific call for a coyote that's walking versus a coyote that's running.
Wow.
And as I said, that has not been the focus of my research. I've been interested in just do they call or don't they call, but there are these other researchers that have made these observations that are just mind-boggling.
Now, I was looking at some of your books and how you actually determine keeping track of a prairie dog is sort of it's not easy because they all sort of look alike. You actually paint them, right?
Yeah. Well, all my research with prairie dogs can be summarized in six words. We catch them, that's two. We mark them, that's four. We watch them, that's six. So, yes, we catch them. We put little ear tags, numbered ear tags in their ears. They're very similar to the earrings that humans wear,
getting
back to humans. And then with a special dye, we paint numbers on their sides. And so we recognize male 37, female 56, and then we also have things like ring around the belly, ring around the collar. And by doing that, we are able to identify every prairie dog in the colony every year. So we know who gets picked off by the badger. We know who mated that day. We know who's very aggressive and who's very submissive. We know who gives alarm calls and does not give alarm calls. So we have them all marked and follow their histories from the time when we first catch them when they're 6 weeks old until they die, and that can be as long as 8 years later.
And how much of their life takes place above ground and how much below ground? And do we have good ways of figuring out what's going on below ground?
Well, most small mammals spend almost their entire lives underground, and that makes them pretty tough to study. But prairie dogs aren't like that, and here's why. They get up in the morning, usually right around sunrise, and they spend the entire day above ground till about sunset. And they're very sedentary, so they live in these small territories. I have an observation tower, and I have 40, 50, sometimes 60 or 70 prairie dogs right in front of me, right below my tower, all day. And they will sometimes go into their burrows. For example, if a predator comes, if he comes close, they'll jump into their burrows. And I have to confess, they have this aggravating habit of going underground for certain key behaviors. For example, most of the matings occur underground. And they do all of their nursing, most of the nursing of their babies underground. But for the most part, they come above ground. They're right there. I can watch them all day long.
Mm. Give us a sense of what your day is like, an average day.
Well, usually I go out. Right now I'm working in New Mexico at the Valle Caudera National Preserve. My students and I usually have four. We have five observation towers, and each person has a tower. We get into the tower early in the morning before the prairie dogs wake up. We stay in those towers all day until the last prairie dog submerges, so that's dawn to dusk. And if we have to trap, then we sometimes have to get out and set or check traps. But for the most part, it's just watching them because we've already marked them. So we record where they get up. We record which females are collecting nest material, who's fighting with whom, who's defending the territory today against the other prairie dogs from other territories, who gives alarm call when the predator comes, who mates with whom. Who's killing babies of prairie dogs? Because that's a big part of the prairie dog story. This infanticide or killing of the babies removes, in some cases, 40% of all babies because the competition is so extreme. Things of that, as I said earlier, it's like watching little people. So there's no shortage of things to record because they're just 40, 50 animals all very active right in front of me.
Give us a sense of what's going on with this infanticide.
It's the most puzzling, fascinating, and bizarre thing I have discovered with prairie dogs. And here's how it works. A female mates, she's pregnant for 35 days, and then she gives birth. And for the next 6 weeks, she keeps her babies underground and goes there periodically to nurse them, and she sleeps with them every night. And they live in these family groups. And competition sometimes within a family group is so extreme because it's early spring, there's not much food. And so this is what I think is going on. We don't have it all figured out, but I think this is going on. Competition is so extreme that in some cases, the only way I can successfully make enough milk for my babies is to kill your babies, eat them, get a good protein meal, so now I'm in a better position to nurse my own babies. So
you'll see mothers killing the babies of other mothers.
That's right. So in every sense, it's a dog-eat-dog world. Now, here's the truly fascinating twist to this, Rich. And the females within these family groups are close relatives. So that means females are killing babies of their own daughters, with their own grand offspring, in other words. They're killing females of their sisters, which would be their nieces and nephews. And so you say, well, gee, that's just totally contrary to the way we think about animals. And indeed, it is totally contrary. And I watched this for 7 years before I published on it because I had to be absolutely certain. And there's no question it's happening. It's taking out 39% of all litters. So that's 2 out of 5. And I think the driving force is this extreme competition among close relatives.
You know, and when you think of large litters, you think of certain number of the litter dying, you know, failure to thrive, that sort of thing. But in this case, you really think it is rival mothers killing others' offspring.
We don't think it. We know it.
You know it.
We have seen it. And we've documented it because sometimes the killer will bring the baby, the victim above ground and cannibalize it right there in front of mm-hmm. our eyes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll do the killing and the cannibalism underground, but then they come up with this bloody face and you see this series of behaviors you don't see at any other time. And then we also actually did some excavations to fully document it. And there's just absolutely no question. This is happening in a big way all the time.
Now, this is also from a species where you'll see a male call out alarm calls to extended family.
Right.
So you would think that those family ties were very strong.
That's exactly. And they are, Rich. It's a case of these families living together and both competition and cooperation being very important. And if it's a great year and there's lots of grass, I'd much rather let your baby survive because they're my nieces and nephews and they're in a grand offspring. But if push gets to shove, then I'd rather my own babies make it than my nieces and nephews and my grand offspring. Bingo, you get infanticide.
So this is you can relate it to conditions like drought,
right,
or especially hard or long winter.
Right. Some years we see more infanticide than we can deal with. Other years it's very rare for just the reasons you said. It's all about female condition and cooperation.
Now, I assume you're watching the social relationships. What happens after one of these events? Does it affect the social relationships within the extended family? Do we have a good sense of what's going on?
Well, yes. In the immediate aftermath, if I'm killing your babies and you catch me, there's just this incredible fight. You are so mad at me. But by that point, it's done. Your babies are done, and I'm the winner, and now I've got a good protein meal, and my babies are going to make it. So, yes, it definitely affects the social system, because if I hadn't killed your babies, then within this family group, there not only would be my offspring, but my grand offspring and my nieces and nephews and my cousins and all that sort. So, yeah, it has incredible consequences for the prairie dogs for the rest of the year and for many years thereafter.
My guest today is Dr. John Hoagland. He's a professor of biology at the University of Maryland, and he's been studying prairie dog behavior and their place in the ecology for over 40 years, author of a number of books. He'll be a guest at the University of Tulsa's Biological Science Seminar this afternoon at 3 o'clock, discussing the behavioral ecology of prairie dogs, insights from the long-term research. And you were telling me before we start, says you're really excited about some new developments. You actually have a robo-snake of some sort?
Yes, absolutely.
So tell me about this. This sounds really interesting.
A guy at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh has just, I think he's just discovered it. I just read about it. It's something called a snake bot, short for robotic snake reverse. So it's a snake bot. And this is a remote-controlled device that can go. It's about the size of a sausage. And I'm thinking that we're going to be able to use this to go right down into prairie dog burrows. And that'll be really helpful for several reasons. First of all, we'll get some information about how prairie dogs will respond to snakes. Snakes are natural predators, but we don't see them very often. But more importantly, these snake bots have lights on them. So we're going to be able to put this snake bot into a burrow and see things that I have been wanting to see for the last 40 years and that many people have tried to see in 38 of those 40 years. So I think this is going to open up a whole new avenue for research, because now, for the first time, we're going to be able to see into these burrows and see some of these key behaviors that the prairie dogs restrict to underground.
You know, I'm going to ask a dumb question, but, you know, you've seen the ant colonies and things like that where you have a basically cutaway of the colony. Has any researcher ever tried to do that in a prairie dog situation?
Yes, Rich, they have tried, but there's a problem. Prairie dogs have these territories that I mentioned earlier, and within these territories, they have many, many burrow systems. So if you do
a cutaway, they just
we're
out
of
here.
We're out of here. They move next door. But what I think is great about these snake bots is that I'll be able to slowly introduce them into the burrow, perhaps over several days, or I don't know how long, and get them down in there so the prairie dogs will acclimate to them, and then we turn on the lights if necessary. We're gonna need some lights for sure. And so for that reason, I think we'll be able to see some things that have eluded us for 40 years.
Now, does this bot really look like a snake, or is it more of just a sort of tube?
It's not a tube. It's sort of like it's almost like a slinky. Uh-huh. It's like a skinny slinky. It's a segmented thing.
So you don't think they'll actually behave as if a snake is in there with them?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I think that's one possibility, that we will get some data on how they respond to the snake bot as though it was a snake. If we get that, fine. But I'm more interested in getting these things down there, getting them set up, so when certain key behaviors happen, we can record them and get some details rather than just saying, well, they were underground for 20 minutes and so a mating probably occurred. I'm thinking we'll be able to see the real deal because of the snake bots.
Now, the predators, it sounds like from the list of predators, most of the predation takes place above ground.
Absolutely, yes.
So the idea of a snake going down in the burrows, does that happen all that much?
Oh, it happens.
Yeah.
But prairie dogs frequently live at high elevations and there aren't very many snakes there. But some of them live in Mexico, southern Texas, Oklahoma, and in warmer climates, snakes can be a significant source of predation. And when I worked on prairie dogs in Arizona several years ago, both rattlesnakes and bull snakes were important because it was warm and the snakes could be active during most of the time when the prairie dogs were active.
Yeah, and they'll go down, and I assume when they go down there, they're usually the winner of the confrontation.
They go down there skinny, they come out fat, and bingo, you just lost five prairie dogs, usually babies, but they can take adults as well.
My guest today is Dr. John Hoagland, a professor of biology at the University of Maryland. He's been studying prairie dog species and their behaviors for over 40 years. He'll be a guest at the University of Tulsa Biological Science Seminar discussing that long-term research. Well, what are some of the things that most people don't understand about prairie dogs that you find really, really interesting that gets people interested in prairie dogs?
Well, as I said earlier, Rich, studying prairie dogs is like studying little people. And I think the thing that is most that people really can identify with is that these prairie dogs have little personalities. Each one has a personality, and they are always looking for ways to gain advantages. And so sometimes gaining an advantage is to give an alarm call so your babies have a better chance to survive. Other times gaining an advantage is to kill the offspring of your close kin because then your own babies have a slightly better. So you get this tremendous variation in what prairie dogs will do to gain a little advantage. And because we have them all marked with those numbers, we know exactly who's doing what all day long for 6 months of the year.
And we talked about the alarms and the infanticide. Can you give us any insights into what their social life is? You mentioned these extended families. Do you see a lot of affection between generations? Do you see affection between extended families?
The basic story is this, Rich. A female prairie dog is born to this territory, and this territory is only about twice the size of this room. It's not very big, so it's the size of the living room of most of your listeners. And with very few exceptions, those females spend their entire lives in that territory. So they're born there, they grow up there, they have babies there,
really?
They have babies again there.
I can't imagine it's only like, 20 yards, 30 yards,
yes,
about like that?
Yes, that's exactly right. And then their babies are born there, and their female babies stay there. And so you get these matrilines, or these groups of females and their daughters and their granddaughters and their nieces and their nephews and their sisters. Males, by contrast, will stay there until they reach sexual maturity, which is either 1 year for some species, 2 years for another, and they disperse. And the reason they disperse is because, in general, females will not mate with their close relatives. So it's all about avoiding incest. So we talk about little people. This reminds me. If a male stays, he has no prospects. The females just will not mate.
So what happens to the males? Do they find another colony close by?
They try. Many males just disperse and die because once they leave the home territory where they know all the burrows and they know who's going to give alarm calls and they feel secure, it's a kamikaze mission. If they were lucky, they will be able to make it into another territory within the home with a home colony, or they might have to leave the colony and away from burrows and other prairie dogs. They're easy prey for the coyotes and the bobcats and the prairie falcons and the eagles.
Yeah. Will they be welcomed into a neighboring colony?
Absolutely not. If I'm a male and I have a harem of seven females, you try and get in there, you got a fight on your hands.
Yeah.
And so frequently what we'll see is that if a male comes into our colony that has about 25 of these family groups, he'll bounce around from family group to family group.
Until he finds a weak male.
Until he finds a weak male, precisely. And then once he finds one, then sometimes it'll be an extended day and a half, 2 or 3 days, where he'll slowly try and wear out the weak male. And the male's weak because he's been defending that territory for the last 6 months, and most of these dispersals occur at the end of the summer when these males, the resident males, are burned out. And so you get this young stud who's been staying home, eating Cheerios for breakfast and steak for supper and just getting big and fat. He comes in and he's ready to roll, and that's how they finally get in. But I have to say that most of the males don't make it because it's not quite a kamikaze mission, but it's very close to that.
Are the predators aware at that time?
Absolutely.
So you're all of a sudden at the end of the summer, you see golden eagles flying overhead. You see badgers nearby.
It's amazing. And that gets back to the point we were talking about prairie dogs as a keystone species. These predators are very aware of times when the prairie dogs are especially vulnerable. And that's one of the times. And let me give you another cool example. Predators are also aware when the females are pregnant. And when they're pregnant, like human females, they can't run very fast. And so that makes them vulnerable. And so the northern goshawks in particular and red foxes key in on that. And they hang around the colony when the females are fat. So if the females just wander a little too far from the home burrow, bingo, the predator races in and grabs the female because she can't run fast.
One last question. That has to do with this sort of historic enmity between humans and the prairie dogs. Is that changing at all, do you think? Are you making inroads with the ranchers and farmers and the people who own the land on the high plains and in the West?
Inroads, yes, but it's a slow process. And here's my feeling about this, Rich. Let's say you're a rancher. You're a rancher. You've got your own ranch. You've got prairie dogs there. I would like for you to keep the prairie dogs there, but it's your ranch and you can do what you want. But I have a problem when you then tell me that you think we should also get rid of the prairie dogs on national parks and on national grasslands because they might then disperse onto your ranch. So you can't have it both ways. And so I think that's the sort of compromise that I think is necessary. Do what you want on your land, but come on, the prairie dogs deserve a place in the sun too for the reasons that we've discussed in this radio broadcast. And so let's allow them to live in some of these sanctuaries on national parks, national grasslands, or other places so that we can preserve the grassland ecosystem of Western North America in at least some isolated spots.
All right. Dr. John Hoagland, thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
John Hoagland is a professor of biology at the University of Maryland. He'll be giving a University of Tulsa biological seminar this afternoon at 3 o'clock in Oliphant Hall on the TU campus on the behavioral ecology of prairie dogs, insights from long-term research. The seminar is free and open to the public. Information at 918-631-2204. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.